This is the FICO Fraud Matters Podcast.
In previous podcasts, we've talked a lot about technology, machines, numbers, hardware, stuff. But what about the humans in the system? Machines don't have emotions or hubris yet, but what about us people? How are we shaping up in this brave new world of finance? Sarah, what does the survey tell us about this, or what is FICO's thoughts on this?
So I think that obviously people are at the heart of this. And I do think that when it comes to fraud, that misconceptions are playing a part in people possibly not being wary enough. So this figure that only 6% of people are worried or their biggest concern is authorised push payment fraud, how we actually worded it to them in the survey, because we wouldn't expect people to know the industry term authorised push payment fraud, is we asked them if they were worried that they could be tricked into sending money to a fraudster. And, you know, it was such a low figure that felt that was a really big worry. And yet we do know that it's one of the fastest growing types of fraud. And I think it's that element of could you be tricked and people thinking, no, I couldn't be tricked, that is leading down that route of perhaps not being as wary as you should be to the different types of approaches that are out there. And the fraud is constantly evolving and there's new types of attack. You know, as Mike said in a previous recording, the fraudsters are very innovative in their approaches. And I don't think that anybody could say that they would never be a victim of fraud. In fact, I wrote in one of my blogs just before Christmas about how I had been a victim of fraud because I wanted to buy some shoes and I'd seen an advert in my Facebook popping up, an advert for a shoe website. Yeah. And I went and ordered not one, but two pairs of shoes from that website and sent the money off. I made a card payment. And gradually then over the following weeks, when the shoes didn't arrive, it occurred to me that this actually was a scam. And that, in effect, I'd been socially engineered to fall for it because I was at a point where I really needed something and was blind to the signals that I should have known about. And I talk about fraud for a big chunk of every day, yeah, and like to think that I'm fairly savvy, but I can fall victim to fraud. And, you know, when I started to talk about this to people, I felt really stupid. It was actually reported in the Express newspaper with the headline that I felt stupid, which was great. So yeah. I think I'm adding that to my LinkedIn profile now. Sarah Rutherford felt stupid, yeah, but I did feel stupid. And that, I think, is one of the problems with human nature and fraud, is that it can be massively underreported because people feel stupid. But, you know, as I talked to people about it and told people what had happened, more and more people told me about their experiences, yeah, and how they had been tricked by all sorts of different scams and your fake shopping websites, offers for things to help with COVID, all sorts of different scams that they'd been impacted by. You know, I started to feel better about myself and having fallen for a scam. And I think we all need to be a little bit more human in how we deal with the victims of fraud and realize that it's not stupidity, but that if you are, you know, impacted at the time when you're under stress, when the fraudster is building urgency, so you might even something as simple as in a Black Friday sale on a scam website where they're saying buy now, it'll be gone tomorrow. Anything that builds urgency can have an impact in making people more likely to fall victim to a fraud. So, yeah, to a certain extent, it is hubris that we think we can't be victims of fraud, and we can. And, you know, by not being wary enough, we're actually laying ourselves open to fraud.
Mike, what do you think? I mean, are the fleshy parts of the system always going to be the weakest links? Are we going to see more of the scammers on Spanish beaches because people just inevitably, eventually fall for these things?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think I mentioned in the previous podcast that, you know, Fagan has gone digital, and that Fagan will, the fraudster will target the point he or she identifies as being the most vulnerable. And because of that, that might be a system, so a bank that's not offering confirmation of payee, or a vulnerability on the way that cards are handled within an organization, or it might be CEO fraud about time and communication and within an organization. But they'll always target that point of vulnerability and prey on the weaknesses that we have, the appetite for a deal, the time challenges, the need just to get it done and move on. And for most of us, it isn't a concern until it hits me or somebody very close to us. And at that point, it becomes the most important thing because it's financially hit us and the worry and the stress that it causes. And, you know, I think it'd be foolish of anybody to think that they're immune to that. We're all more vulnerable than we think. And I would say, actually, consumers, the UK population, we don't need to know about what is really an APP fraud. We don't need to know all the mechanics of how it works. What we need to do is to have our eyes wide open when we're making payments. And there's UK Finance run a campaign called Take Five that really just tries to say to us, when you're making a payment, it takes us through this idea of stopping, of challenging, and of looking to protect ourselves. And if we focus on those things, then actually we've got the opportunity to protect ourselves and our money. If we start thinking that we're, you know, we're immune and we're savvy and clever enough, then we just open ourselves up to fail. So I think that accept that we are vulnerable, accept Fagan's gone digital, and look to be careful about what we do when we're asked to make a payment, particularly if someone says, I need this quickly, or you must make this decision now, or can you do it differently this time? Mm-hmm. So those basic red flags in our brain should be flagging up at that point.
You're listening to the FICO Fraud Matters podcast.
Sarah, let's turn to the FICO survey again, to over 12,000 organisations in 12 nations. And what did that tell us about consumers' knowledge or concern about fraud?
Yeah, so if we look at the UK results, about 15% of people said that they had been the victim of account takeover fraud. So they knew that their frauds had tried to use their account. That's slightly less than it was globally, whereas 18%. Now, you might think, well, 15%, maybe that's not so high, 15% of people knowing that they've had their account taken over. Again, if you look at the estimated number of bank accounts, 55 million Brits have got a bank account. So that's 8.25 million people who say they've been a victim of fraud and, you know, admitted it. It was an anonymous survey. So I think we do know that there are a lot of worries about fraud, and that it is something that's very real to people. When we look at the protections that are in place to prevent fraud and people's attitudes to those, because you have to look at that flip side of, well, when people put protection in place to help people not be defrauded, what do they think about that? And so one of those was asking them around declined purchases and what was their reaction to having purchases declined. And 19% of people were positive. So they had positive emotions around having a transaction declined either online or in store. So they recognized that it was a value in fraud prevention. And actually, those people that had reported they'd previously been a victim of fraud were more likely to feel positive about having those checks happen. And I think in the past, people were much more, you know, if you were in the queue in a shop and you had your card declined, you were much more likely to think that people around you were judging you as not having the money in your account. Whereas I think nowadays it seems that people are more willing to accept that fraud protection is a very real thing and that it's not necessarily an embarrassment to have your card stocked in a store. But I have to say, just before Christmas, I went to purchase an electronic in John Lewis. I hadn't done any in-store shopping for a long, long time of that kind. I certainly don't buy electronics in John Lewis very often. And I had all three of my cards declined. So it can be a little bit problematic when that happens. But nevertheless, you've got to understand it's for protection. And most people were neutral about it, but about 38, 39% were negative connotations to having one of their transactions stopped for fraud concerns. I think when it happens is when that accumulates and they use a card on a number of occasions and it's stopped one after the other. Over 50% said that they would switch provider if there were four or more declines. So, you know, they tried to use their card on four occasions and it had been declined on each occasion, then they would switch their provider. And 34% said they would switch their provider after just two or three declines. So it really is about managing those expectations with people that sometimes for their protection, their card will be declined. But I think also looking at how you get those declined transactions back on track when it actually was a legitimate purchase. So, for example, if you decline a transaction that you are sending an SMS or an app notification to the person saying, hey, this is your bank, was that really you? And they can respond yes, and then that transaction can go through, then that's a much more positive experience. And I think it's patchy in how that has been implemented by the banks.
Mike, are the banks implementing this fast enough? Is there things that they can be doing?
Well, I think the strong customer authentication has probably been implemented over a longer time frame than we perhaps all wanted. But for me, the important thing is that when these things are implemented, they're implemented right, and that the level of friction is acceptable. So the friction that's introduced meets the need of dealing with a fraudster, but also it doesn't. It's the minimal impact in terms of the transfer of that money, the payment being made, and the goods and services that it supports. So I don't think it's a question of fast enough. I think it's a question of doing it and doing it well, that it addresses the need without causing too much upset. But of course, you have to be very, I think we've all got to be very clear that, you know, the percentages of reported numbers that Sarah and FICO talk about, at one end, it's Germany at 17%, India 66%, and UK at 41%, so two-thirds the way through. They're fine about reporting. You translate that into money, to pounds and pence. We're talking about £479 million in 2020, and that rose by 71% in the first 6 months of 21. Yeah. So it is a very significant amount of money that has a huge impact on folk, and we've got to make sure that whatever we do, introducing stuff to thwart the fraudster, we do it well, and it both doesn't constrain trade, but it does thwart the fraudster.
It's that balancing act again, isn't it? The bank balancing act. It's absolutely that, getting all of these things right. If you can get scammed, Sarah, what hope do 8 billion other people have? So do all 8 billion, I always round things up, do all 8 billion of us need to have one fraud crime committed against us before we all learn? Or can we really pass it on without being victims of fraud ourselves?
I mean, you've got to have a think about the seriousness of it as well. So, you know, I gave the example of myself falling victim to a shopping fraud. And, you know, I think there's a lot that we can unpack in terms of a shopping fraud and where the responsibility actually lies with that. But the loss to me was under £60. The other case that I talked about in another podcast where somebody was tricked with a Hey Mom WhatsApp scam, they lost £3,000. So, you know, there's different scales and different people have different vulnerabilities. So I don't think that necessarily you can cure, you know, it's not like having a vaccine and having a minor case of fraud will then protect you from all future frauds. In fact, anecdotally, we've heard about the fact that fraudsters share the names and details of people that have fallen victim to fraud because they've basically earmarked them as people that could fall victims again. So unfortunately, not everyone learns from experience. And that does mean that some people are more vulnerable than others. But yes, absolutely, we could all fall victims to some kind of fraud.
There's no vaccine for this. We have to learn to live with the fraud. Is this right? Is this very 2022, very COVID?
So, well, it's a very complex issue. And I don't think that we can say as individuals, we have to live with it. You know, everybody is on their own path with this, which is quite empowering in a way, because it means that people can learn, people can do the right things to protect themselves. They can develop the ability to use password managers, for example. They can develop the ability to spot the signs of fraud. They can be reached by the education of, you know, the Take Five campaign and other organizations that are putting out. All of the knowledge is out there and available to help you to protect yourself. It's just that not everybody is in the same place in terms of being able to do that, and not everyone can do it for every scam type. So I don't think that I would be likely to fall for a romance scam. And I think my other half might be quite pleased to hear that. Hope he is. But, you know, some people are more vulnerable to that kind of scam. So it's definitely not a one-size-fits-all approach. And we don't know what terrible new thing fraudsters are going to come up with next. And certainly when they start out with these schemes and people are unfamiliar with them, then they're more likely to become victims. And certainly, you know, I know several people who have fallen for the shopping scams, because when you see the adverts online, when your Facebook feed or you go to an online newspaper and you see the same advert, and you go to an online magazine and you see the same advert. So you're seeing the same advert pushed into your social media and other feeds all the time when you're online. And that gives it legitimacy. So you start to think, well, Facebook's allowing them to advertise and Google's allowing them to get up the rankings in terms of search engine optimization for these things that aren't really real. These are not real merchants. And behind that, there are merchant acquirers that are actually offering services because they're taking card payments. So they have to somehow have the ability, they have to have an account with a merchant acquirer in order to be able to take those payments. So there is a whole ecosystem of different types of organizations that have some level of responsibility for making sure that this type of fraud doesn't continue to happen. And so absolutely people have to play their part, but everyone in the ecosystem has a place to put, you know, something that they can do to help stop this type of fraud. I think better due diligence by the organizations that provide services to what are ultimately fraudsters is something that needs to be well up on the agenda.
You know, there's an adage that, you know, if something's too good to be true, it probably is. And I think that adage is absolutely correct, but it's really just too simple to say that to people. But I think if you look at when fraud happens, it's the start point that always has a different flavor. So the start point is a hey mum, it's a crypto, it's a romance fraud, it's a CEO fraud. The digital Fagin will always try and reinvent new scenarios. They would then also try to use information that they really shouldn't have, that they've obtained by whatever source, things like date of birth, address, or bank account, or whatever they find. And then they present you with the opportunity to buy a good or a service and start to instigate red flags, you know, an urgency of payment, an offer that closes in a certain time, or something to try and make you circumvent those normal decisions you'd make in your mind. But however different that first point is, how it's instigated, however much info they use about you, however much, you know, pressure they put on you around time or urgency, the consequence is money transfers from A to B. And I think if you look at the great stuff that UK Finance do around Take Five, it's saying stop, look, protect, think about what you're doing. Does it absolutely make sense? So I think the biggest piece of advice that we could have is that Take Five is just stop, take time out. You know, am I certain that there are not some events going on here that are causing me to do something that ordinarily I wouldn't do? Now, banks can help. Banks can provide tools to us to help us do that. Confirmation of pay, request to pay, strong customer authentication. There are lots of mitigants to fraud and deception. They can provide nudges and prompts, and we've spoken about that in previous podcasts. I do think there's a piece of work to do to understand where liability should sit and where that liability is appropriately balanced between me as a consumer and my bank and my payment provider and the recipient of that money. So where does the liability sit? But as Sarah just mentioned, you know, there's another really important thing here is for money to leave my account and to go to somebody else's account in a way that's inappropriate does require somebody to have provided card-based merchant services, payment system access, and the ability to transfer money from A to B. So the fact of how organizations onboard companies and service their payment needs is really important, because a bit like some of those things we're seeing at the moment around payments to and from Russia, whatever you do, if nobody provides that payment mechanism, the money can't move from A to B. So I think there's an obligation there about understanding around onboarding and the responsibilities people have around the provision of services. And you only have to look at the Financial Conduct Authority's website and look at their newsfeed and see examples of when these things go wrong and the fact that below that, people are providing them with payment services.
You're listening to the FICO Fraud Matters podcast.
This is great stuff. So we're talking about social engineering here. We're talking about nudges and prompts. And in the broader world, we're seeing disinformation in the political world. Marketing has always been based on lies. And we're here now talking about finance and scams and things like this. Is there a societal requirement for us as individuals to be more aware of influence? And there we are. We have influences that are a thing these days. Is there just an awareness in society that they should be aware of manipulation, that perhaps they didn't have that requirement in the past?
I don't think that it's new. I think it's maybe scaled. I mean, you know, there's some great stories about past scoundrels that have ran romance scams, but they had to do it in the real world because digital world did not exist. There's always been people that have committed crime, but as Mike says, Fagin's gone digital, and it's very much that the difference is the channels that they have gone to and the payments infrastructure that is required in order to enable them to get hold of their ill-gotten gains, where things have changed more. But I don't think it's new to have these types of crimes. There's always been bad people.
Okay.
You know what? There's nothing new under the sun. From the establishment of the railroads, the Industrial Revolution, through the gold rush, folk have always been scammed in different ways. I think that all we're seeing in the past few years is the ability of social networks, of interconnectivity, of the internet, and now enabling people to scale what they're doing, but also use the information they have to target people in a particular way. So I think people have always been out to defraud people and be nasty people. That's not a new phenomenon, but I think that that's always been the case. And I think our job today is harder than it has ever been to resist that because of the way that the web works, the way that social engineering is used. And it just means that we've got to be our eyes wide open so much more than it ever has been the case, because things appear legitimate when often they're not.
Just for context, Mike, if someone was to say to you, how old is digital banking? How old is online banking? I mean, what does that date back to?
I think we probably saw our first sort of banking very early on in the 1980s with Halifax. And I think it was called, it was Halifax and Prestel, and it was called Hobbs or something like that, Halifax Online Banking, and then Midland. But really, teletext, television-based in the 80s. In the 90s, we started to see the first iterations of real online banking, mostly around dial-up and internet, very slow, very limited functionality. But, you know, the revolution in the 2000s around the web and internet protocols, and then the adoption of mobile technology and apps has really seen that move significantly forward. But probably, you know, we were working out what it meant in the 80s. In the 90s, it was about proving. And as you go into the 2000s, it's become a reality and has become our bank. It's the way we do our banking and manage our money now.
So if we take the middle of those two, so we say the 80s is the early adopters, the 80s are those people that don't remember a time before the internet, but in the 90s is when it came about. So online banking, digital banking is less than 30 years old. Is that right?
I think so. I think, you know, peak check was 1990. Now, 1990 was the point that we moved away from the majority of our payments being made by check, by paper analog instruments, into electronic. And obviously that meant BACS and CHAMPS and faster payments and cards and that sort of stuff. The overlay of online banking has built onto that. But, you know, there's a whole chunk of our society now who know no different than living in an online world and managing their whole life online. And banking's no different to that. They think a checkbook is an antiquated historical artifact, and they probably think a £10 note is an interesting thing their grandma gave them for Christmas. The reality is a growing number of our society are living completely immersed in a digital world. And why would we think banking is any different?
Absolutely. Final question, Mike, when was the last time you wrote a checkout?
I honestly can't remember. I know where I've got, for one of my banks, I do have a checkbook. I can't remember the last time I wrote a check. Equally, I can't remember the last time I used a note, a £5 note, £10 note, or any coins. I've been completely cashless for about 4 or 5 years.
Sarah, how about you? The last time you wrote a check?
The last time I wrote a check was December 2019. And that was for a very specific purpose, because I wanted to give my 2 sons some money towards house deposits. I wanted to be able to present that to them in some packaging. And there isn't a good digital way of doing that. But prior to that, I hadn't written checks for many years. So I actually had to go and apply to get a checkbook in order to be able to do that. And those are the only two checks that have been used out of that checkbook. And then, of course, I think in the end, one of my sons did pay in the check, and the other one, I ended up doing a bank transfer and ripping up the check anyway. So it was very more symbolic than actual check usage, I guess. I will say, however, the last time I received a check was this weekend just gone, when I got a check for the grand sum of £17 from the DVLA. Fortunately, I can go back to the digital world and scan that check into my bank account without actually having to go to the trouble of visiting a branch.
Fantastic. So there's progress even if the DVLA aren't on board.
Correct.
Excellent. So Sarah, Mike, thank you very much indeed for that.
Thank you. Not a problem. It's been a pleasure to be with you today and featuring on these podcasts.
Thanks, George. And a great thank you to Mike for joining us on this FICO podcast. His expertise and his amazing delivery of the great stories has been absolutely fantastic and very engaging. Thank you, Mike.
If you'd like to know more about FICO, contact us today via our website at fico.com/fraud.